Hello everyone and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present and future of all things business in esports. I'm your host, Joe Hills, and for this episode we are going to be spotlighting the Houston Outlaws and their journey through season one, onwards to season two, and any lessons learned along the way. The man who's going to be taking us along this journey is going to be Matt Flame Rodriguez, who is the GM for the Houston Outlaws. It was a pro back in Team Fortress 2 and also early in Overwatch, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
we'll talk about that.
Yeah. we'll get into that later on. But yeah, welcome to the show. You're on site here at Infinite HQ for a few days before heading back out west. You drove here with your dog, right?
Yep.
And that was like a very important thing for you to do.
Well, it was more like I didn't know how long I was going to be here. And yeah. I didn't want to be like, oh, hey, dog sitter, you know, watch this tyrant for an undefined amount of time. And so like, I figured it would just be better to bring her out instead of worrying about that.
Is she a bit of a nightmare? Or?
She's a bit of a, I'd say handful.
Okay. Yeah, I'm hoping by maybe first few months of next year that I can pick one up once my routine is a little bit more stable. But it's a completely different environment owning a dog over here. Like, you've got to be wary of how hot the pavement is, and like the exercise routine is very different, and like you can't let them off the lead as well. Like in the UK, everyone lets their dogs off the lead when they go for a walk.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost impolite here, which is strange. But yeah, that's not really esports, so people don't really.
In the future, maybe dogs will run esports.
Maybe they were in space. Now they're going to be on the main stage at the international in a few years. Cool. So let's just dive into your story. How did you get to where you are today? What brought you into this area of hardcore competitive gaming? Was there anything from your youth that really like pushed you into this area? Like any backstory?
I mean, I guess it's like cliche, right? Like if you ever ask somebody what got you into esports or whatever, they're like, oh yeah, I used to play my Game Boy and I was like really into Tetris. Like, I mean, but that's kind of like my story is like, I feel like as a kid, I was like super into video games. Like, I did normal sports a lot, but it was always like after you got home from normal sports, you do your homework and then like, then what? And I feel like I got into PC gaming like sometime in high school, but like before that I was probably playing like a million hours of like Pokemon Stadium or like... Sure. You know, Bomberman 64, like those kind of games. And I think I was like born with a Game Boy. Like, I don't remember not having a Game Boy as a person, like as a human on this planet. So I feel like I was just like always kind of around gaming. And then my parents were pretty like restrictive of it. Like not to the point where like they wouldn't let me play, but they were like aware, I guess.
Yeah.
They were like, you know, this kid's into it, you know. So like they were pretty supportive, I would say, even like when I was like really young.
So were they playing with you or no?
So like when I was really little, when I was like five, it's like the earliest memory I probably have. When I was like five or six, my dad got in like a really bad accident. And I remember going to the hospital and like playing Game Boy with him, like while he was like in a hospital bed, like recovering from surgery. And so I feel like...
It's intense.
Yeah, but I feel like for him even, it was like he was into it. He worked for like the military. So I think like gaming was like this like weird side hobby that he had, or he was in the military. So then I think for whatever reason, it always stuck with me. Like, it was just fun. Like, you would just sit there and play games and like it didn't matter what was going on outside of the world, you know. Like, it didn't matter that your dad, like, it matters that your dad's in the hospital, but like if you're at the hospital playing video games with your dad, it doesn't matter that he's at the hospital, you know. It's like it gives you like this sense of
normality.
Yeah,
right? Like
it brings you back,
especially as a kid who's much more, you know, present in the moment. Like I had a whole bunch of stuff that went on with my mum being like really really ill when I was younger. Like, she had lupus, like a really acute case of that. So I think a lot of my early years were kind of just like phased around people trying to protect me from like
the reality.
Yeah, the reality of actually what was happening. And then games just became a thing that I got stuck into. Mine was like Lego Island.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah. Still play it every single day today, throwing pizzas out of the...
I tried to download it actually like recently, like within the past like 2 years, and I couldn't get it to work. I feel like every time I was trying to download, I was getting like a virus. Like, I feel like it was like a bait. Like, people knew that like there were people in their 20s and 30s trying to download it.
Yeah.
And then like they would just like exploit that. It was like for like Windows 95. That was like...
Yeah, that was old school. And then there was like a Racer, Age of Empires.
I actually named my dog Pepper, my last dog.
That's a deep cut right there.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. He passed away, unfortunately, but Pepper. And then I didn't make the connection until later, where I was like, oh wait, that was the name of the main character in Lego Island.
That's awesome. I love that. I love that. I've flirted with a whole host of names for the dog that I ultimately want to have. And like, it's probably going to be Boars or something stupid from like Arthurian legend. I've always liked that name. But cool. So you started off when you were younger. It was something that kind of brought you and your family together. How did you get into the pro scene?
I guess in high school, I was playing like this game. It was called like Digital Paintball 2. It's like this really like bad Quake 2 mod. And it wasn't bad. It was just like simple. But like the concept of it was pretty much like and a paintball, except you had like real movement abilities, and there was like surfing and strafing, and like you could where you just like keep gaining speed and you could like launch yourself off ramps.
Okay.
So like, but it was all very mechanic heavy based, like aiming. The guns were all projectile and it was like one shot kill. So like you'd be very good at movement, you had to be very good at like aiming, you had to be very good at like sure. just like mechanics. And then I got really good at that, and then when I got to college after I finished high school, they were like, my friend, one of my roommates was playing TF2 and he was like, oh, you should try this out. And then at the time I was like, okay, cool. But I guess I didn't realize how much of a competitive person I was until then, like in college. And I was like, oh, like this is fun, like I'm enjoying, you know, getting better at this. And I think that's like something that esports brings to the table for a lot of people, is like a sense of progression.
Yeah, and like it's almost unendless.
Yeah,
because you can always get better in one aspect of your play or your mentality, right?
So like that's like something that's like measurable, I think, for a lot of people. So like you go to college and, you know, your grades go up, but I mean, depending on who you are, your grades have a cap, right? Like you can't beat 100 on your score. You can't like be that much better than the kid sitting next to you in your class in any measurable way without like some sort of actual testing. But back to the point of like esports, when you're playing a video game, there's no limit to how good you can get. Like you can always find a way to make yourself better, and you can always find a way to make yourself stand out from the guy next to you. I think that's like something that is unique to the space, which I think exists in traditional sports. But I mean, I think traditional sports aren't for everybody. I think the one thing that's cool about esports too is that there's no physical limitations. I mean, you could argue that the smallest person in the world could play basketball, but realistically, it's like not as easy, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of the same with football. Like, I think genetics play a bigger part in traditional sports and not so much in esports, obviously.
What was the sports that you were most involved in when you were younger?
I played soccer from when I was European football.
Early adopter, wow.
And from when I was like 6 to like 16, I would say. And then 17, 18, I played high school football. I was like very large for soccer, and it made more sense to put me on the football field, I think. And that was actually probably one of the best decisions I made, actually, from like a career standpoint, because I think football taught me a lot more about like leadership and teamwork and like the mentality that you should have for like success. I didn't play too much because I was like, that was like my first year of football. I was like, oh, welcome to high school, senior year football or junior year football. Like, I've never played before. Let's see what happens. But that year we went to the finals of state finals, and like learning or like seeing firsthand that mentality, like that very like team oriented mentality, that like team first, coach first, we're a unit kind of mentality.
Yeah, like
I think was super.
Like you play for other people in your team.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the biggest things for me playing rugby was, you know, I played for local team. We got to one of the, there were two competitions. We dropped out of the first one, but we got to like one of the finals in one of the other ones for the entire country. And I kind of flirted between our first team and our next team. And one of the things that I learned from playing more in the lower team, just because I was such a late bloomer into puberty, like I was tall, but I was like high voice, stammering, like you've got all these other like kids with beards rocking around. But one of the biggest things that I learned for playing for that other team was, it was mostly a lot of the other smaller guys, but everyone actually played for each other, and that sense of kind of brotherhood was actually really super impactful on me as a young kid. Like there was one time when one of my teammates would get like a late tackle, and then I'd see the guy on the other team like do a high five, and it's just like red mist.
Yeah.
It's bad. But yeah, like you learn a lot from those years, I think.
Yeah, I think one thing too, like from playing soccer for so long and then going straight to football, I think I learned like the contrast in terms of like what's a good team, what's a bad team. Like our soccer team wasn't bad, but the mentality of the team was trash, I would say. There's a lot of like bullying and like a lot of like stuff that like really just shouldn't happen on a team. And it was interesting to see like the dynamics between like seniors and freshmen in high school. Like you see like on the soccer team, it'd be like the seniors picking on the freshmen. But on the football team, it was like the seniors kind of like trying to protect and, you know, like prop up the freshmen. Like, hey, you're like the future. I need you to be the best, et cetera. Like you're living on my
legacy.
That's
pretty inspiring.
So. Yeah. So it was it was different. Like you like leave one awful atmosphere and then you're thrown into a very supportive one where you have to like earn your right to get the support. Like if like, for example, if like a freshman football player was getting bullied in the hallway and a senior from the football, like from like the varsity team saw that happening, like they would just step in, you know, like end it right there, because whoever's bullying this freshman like is obviously not on the football team. And then suddenly there's like a respect for that football team. And so you always had like this sense of like the team has your back in and out of game. And like seeing how that was created and like what that felt like, I think made me want to like apply it to other things.
Sure.
But that was like a big stepping stone, I would say, in terms of me learning team dynamics and like what's good, what's bad.
And those are obviously some core skills that you use on a daily basis in
for sure
with the Outlaws. But just help us understand how you got to that position just in a few minutes. So I assume that you ended up through the paintball piece, kind of having that love for the high mechanics, and then going into Team Fortress 2 and then into Overwatch, like a lot of the pros did. At what point did team management become something that you were very focused on?
Like pursuing?
Yeah. Or
I guess excelling in? Yeah, I guess from like a playing perspective, I think team dynamics in esports for the most part are pretty like, they're hard to work around. Like it's like a lot of things are out of your control because there's no structure. And like Team Fortress 2 especially didn't really have a structure. It was kind of like you were in the group, you were like in the circle, you were out of the circle, right?
Yeah.
And so like if one day like some kid on the internet just decided he didn't like you, then like suddenly you could just like be off a team. And that's kind of how even Overwatch was at the beginning. I was also working full-time jobs, like I was never not working, so like it was hard for me to always commit. Like I felt bad when I was on Splice, especially for Overwatch, because like I would be working a 9-to-5. I get home at 6, I'm like dead, you know, like I'm already like I've already had a long day and I'm not trying to play games, like I'm trying to play games, but now I'm like it's like a second job.
Yeah.
And I'm getting paid a second salary essentially. And so like it hit a point where it was like, okay, I can't make this work. And I couldn't justify quitting my job to pursue the like year one salaries of an Overwatch, right? Like that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So it was like, what are my avenues for a career that I can like sustain with, you know, and make money and have like a growth path? Like being a player has a growth path in specific scenarios, right? Like some orgs, Infinite for example, has like a lot of infrastructure. And so if you're a player with Infinite, with Optic, with Outlaws, there's always going to be like connections you can make and, you know, places potentially to get hired beyond your playing career.
Yeah.
So like stuff like that is very intriguing from my perspective, because at least I'm like, now I'm in a position, the idea of being in a position where I can shape esports in the future is very appealing, I think, because I think that there are a lot of problems with the current, or maybe like the past 10 years worth of esports, kind of the way it was being done. And so the only way to fix that is to get in there, right? Like to get a position where you can, you know, start influencing some change. And I think that that desire to like influence change or like make a dent in the current way of doing things was more my drive than like saying, oh, you know, I want to be a manager. But I think my skills lent more towards like the managing and player management stuff.
So I remember from the early pieces of content and also speaking with the players that a lot of them were really excited to come and play on the team, specifically, you know, because you were here and also because a few of the other players had already signed on. That was something that resonated with me with some of the earlier pieces of content. So it seems like a lot of people in esports, especially the management side and myself as well, you know, like you step into like a new opportunity where there's a lot of challenges. You don't necessarily have, you know, like a proven track record doing this specific role, but you have the kind of soft skills to make it work and actually kind of make it your own. So growing over the course of season one, obviously a lot of changes, be it bringing on new players and subs, you know, just building a structure and a culture around these players, having to kind of switch around who's going to be taking the lead based on the meta and everything like that. What have been the major lessons that you've learned as a coach, and also what do you feel like your team has learned in terms of areas that they've excelled at, but also areas that they really want to work on for next season?
Yeah, I mean, season one was like very much a shot in the dark, right? It was like every team just hired a GM, hired some staff, and hired some players, and we're like, go. And I think from like a planning perspective, we had a good season. I think from a player perspective, the season was good. Obviously, we didn't make playoffs, sucks, but from like their mentality, I felt like it was very positive. I felt like everyone felt like they were improving over the season. Lessons learned, though, I think like every stage we would learn something new. Like stage one, I think we realized we were spending too much time on practice, not enough time on VOD review. And then stage two, I think we were we had like worked so hard in stage one that we like had this expectation of like grandeur in stage two, and then when that didn't happen, it like really took a mental toll on everybody. And so then that was a lesson, like, you know, don't overhype yourself, don't get cocky, don't, you know,
stay in the moment, right?
Yeah, don't stay in the moment, you have to like keep grinding. Stage three, I would say, was like a big, was like an expansion on that in some way. Like, it was like people getting out of their mental rut was really hard, coaching too as well. Like, it was very stressful for everybody on the team, staff included, I think staff especially. And so like when the staff are stressed out, it obviously goes straight to the players. Like, so like that's a big thing for this year, is like, let's make sure that the staff are feeling good all the time, and if they're not, we give them whatever they need to, you know, succeed. Because back to the way that I wanted the team to be, like more of a group think structure, if your leader is not, like, if the leaders aren't mentally set, then the players can't be mentally set. And yeah, so like there's a lot of stuff like that that I think I learned in terms of like prioritizing mental health a lot more, prioritizing breaks a lot more. Is there a limit to how much content we can really be putting out every week? Like, we killed it in content last year, but was there a cost? You know, like, what did that look like? Were some of the things worth that we did? Do we have more leverage? I think one of the things too that you learn, or I learned, is like at the beginning when you're taking a new job, and this is everywhere, right? Every new job you take, you're always like, I gotta do my best. I gotta, like, you know, make everyone happy.
Sure.
And that was probably one of my biggest flaws, was like, oh, you guys want to do a photo shoot at 7 a.m.? Sure, let's go. But like next season, I'm going to be like, let's wait till 10. Let's wait till 11. You know, like, let them sleep, because you can't mess up their schedules.
Yeah. And I, so, I mean, that's one of the, yeah, that's one of the massive areas that IPI kind of prioritizes. And a lot of the research that they quote whenever I go and speak with Taylor and those guys is that a lack of sleep brings ramifications very similar to, you know, having...
being drunk or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you... many beers, so having that kind of structure and stability is really important. There are one or two areas that I actually want to mine into off the back of that. One being looking at how the esports industry has evolved with inflating player salaries. A lot of the budget for building teams has gone on to player salaries, and you've pretty much just like found someone to run that team. It seems like in the course of the last 2 years specifically, the investment that goes into actually providing that structure, that routine, those resources, those leaders in various areas, you know, be it overall management, in-game mechanics, strategy, mental well-being, that's a really positive evolution in the industry. So it's quite curious for you to mention that's, you know, already one of the growing lessons that you've learned from this season, seeing how much structure actually elevates everyone else. I know that sleep is a really important thing, especially for pro players. So it's very hard to change behavioral. It's just very hard to change behavior, and working on the right way to communicate why people should change how they're structuring their day, even if they are one of the best players in the world. So that's really interesting. The other area that I kind of wanted to quiz you on is those kind of out of game expectations. This industry thrives on sponsorship revenue and merchandising. We've spoken before this, and you said that the T-Mobile deal was actually a lot of fun for the players. It wasn't super high impact in terms of disrupting their schedule, but, you know, what is your view on how you protect the players, but you also build the brand and the business around that? Because that has to be a healthy balance that, you know, every side of the table has to kind of be aware of, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think from the perspective of the players, if you look at like the T-Mobile sponsorship specifically, it was like very low impact to them as individuals. It didn't like change their contract expectations too much. It was like, you know, promote obviously and like be a good brand ambassador.
And they were fantastic.
Yeah. And I think being a brand ambassador is one of the things that like we drilled into them early. You know, it's like everything you do is scrutinized. Everything you do is out there. Like, you can't say one bad word on your stream. Someone will Twitch clip it and it will be there for the rest of your life. And in 10 years from now, you don't want, like, I don't know, Elon Musk saying, oh, SpaceX can't send a picture of Rockus to the moon because we have this Twitch clip of Rockus from 2010 where he drops a bad word in his Twitch chat, you know? And like, so like, that's like something that I think was really important and something that I think led to them having a lot more success in that department in terms of like, you know, you're not representing just Outlaws, you're representing Optic, you're representing Infinite, you're representing all of esports, you're representing any brand that wants to put their name associated with any of us. So for like the Turtle Beaches, the T-Mobiles, the DX Racers, it's like anything you do is going to reflect on them in some way.
Yeah, that's why you've seen players like IOC being pushed by Blizzard to represent on the casting desk for finals with Raucus or on live TV broadcast too. So that's, it must be an incredible journey for players and management alike in the first season of a franchise league like this, where everything is new, all the spotlight is on you, and 12 months down the line, the amount of interaction that you get from the community either affects you in one way or another. I don't think that, you know, the human brain is actually... it's not supposed to deal with that much attention.
Yeah, right? it's going to affect people one way or another. Yeah, it's interesting because when you look at it from my perspective, it's like, okay, the first week everyone's like excited, you know, like USA Today wants your interview. And then like, okay, you get excited for that. Players get excited for that. Then it's like Forbes wants your interview, you know? And then you're like, okay, cool. And then it's like the Today Show wants you on live TV. And then you're like, what? Okay. Yeah. And then like suddenly it becomes normal. Like it stops becoming like crazy or like impressive. You're just like, okay, this is the job now. Like yeah. it's still impressive, it's still awesome, but it the amount of like stress it puts you under, or like the amount of duress that you feel is substantially lower, because you're like, okay, I've done this before, I've done a million interviews now. Like the beginning of the season was it was hectic in that regard, because you weren't used to it, you know. It was just like, this is happening, like, okay, I have to respond to this email, because if I don't respond to this email, what if he loses this interview, or you know, something like that. And then you realize like, okay, take a deep breath, like these people are also working normal jobs. Like these people are also, you know, they're not waiting on me. Like if it takes me 2 hours to respond, it's not going to be the end of the world. Like
yeah.
That mentality is what needed to happen. I think it happened a little too late for me. I'm still struggling with it actually, but understanding, you know, deadlines and schedules and not feeling like I need to be on top of everything at all times. But yeah, it's been good, because I think too, when you have a player like Jake, like Raucus or Muma, Kuma, you know, these players that are very good at representing the brand, it inspires the next generation. It inspires the players that are on the team that aren't getting the amount of exposure maybe they want, and then pushes them to, like, you know, start actively changing their lifestyle, you know, maybe do more interviews, ask for more interviews, find more opportunities to get their name out there so that they can replicate what they're doing,
yeah,
what like the other players are doing. And then obviously that culture is like what I want, what like any team should want. You know, you want players that are pushing each other to do more content. Like that's insane, right? It's like, oh, well, how come you get to go to PAX? I want to go to PAX. You know, like that's good. Like from my perspective, that is really good. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, well, you know, you went to PAX last week, you know, let this player go to PAX next week, or let this player go to E3 since you just went to PAX, you know, like, but that's like a good conversation. That's like what I want. That's like what any team should want.
Yeah.
And like having that now already is very beneficial. And it makes my life a lot easier, especially if like I don't have to convince people to do things, you know. And that mentality, that group mentality of them all just fighting for a spotlight, but also maintaining respect and maintaining like that team feel, and like, you know, this player's doing this for my benefit. It's like, okay, Jake's representing the team at the Olympics. He's representing all of us at the Olympics. Like we have to prop up Jake. We have to help Jake do his job the best that he can. And it's the same when you're in the server, right? It's like, maybe one player is having a bad day, it's like it's on the rest of the team to make that player have a good day, because if that player is struggling, you're all struggling.
Yeah, like you need to offer a hand up, either mentally or
make up for it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Or step up and fill the void. It's one of the things that I've realized actually stepping into a larger business where there are lots of people that share my passion, is that not everyone has a good day, but it takes one good word or one proactive piece of someone taking a step or a slice out of their day to do something just for someone else in a very selfless way, because they're emotionally aware enough just to realize that has such a huge impact. I mean, I felt that here, and I've spoken with other people that I've noticed have been, you know, struggling in that way too, and I can't imagine how much that's magnified on the world stage when it's not just business strategy thing or your own mental state, but it's keeping your mind as clear as possible to make those snap second choices that involve processing just an incredible amount of data instantaneously. So I can imagine there's a huge amount of pressure there, and actually having a brotherhood or a groupthink mentality to a team is pretty special. And I actually think that shines through in the content and also just how the players actually present themselves. Like I do feel like the Houston Outlaws, that they have one of the strongest fan bases out there, not just because of, you know, our team here, like with Markel Lee that was on the show last week, but just because of the players are such genuine ambassadors and actually care a lot for each other. So that's really important. Let's gaze forward towards next year and maybe the year after that too. Lots of learnings, lots of growth, lots of structural changes, new organizations entering into the Overwatch landscape, from Paris, from Toronto, one other Chinese team is confirmed. Perhaps there'll be another one going public soon. I kind of really want to more mine down into your thoughts on how home and away is actually going to impact the state of pro play. It's hard to pass comment on something that's so in flux still and like isn't certain about how it's going to work. But I can only imagine that if teams are roving around on a weekly basis, that that's just going to make the overall standard of play go down and the mental health of the players go down too, especially if there isn't a structure in place to enable that to be super successful.
Yeah, I think infrastructure is going to be the biggest thing. I think one of the benefits, obviously, to Outlaws is that we have this whole, you know, setup that we're at right now.
Yeah.
If, like, there's a game in Houston on, like, a Friday, we can fly out, you know, Sunday and practice here, and, like, we won't miss a beat. Obviously, flying is its own animal for some people. Some people don't like flights. Mm-hmm. 3 hours, spending 6 hours a week on your plane isn't too inviting, right? But realistically, depends on the schedule, right? I don't think Blizzard's current schedule would work in any capacity for like a home away system, but maybe like one match a week, two matches a week at your home stadium, or, you know, something along those lines. That's another question, but the standard of play obviously might suffer, but at the same time, I think the quality of salaries and stuff like that, like infrastructure can only go up because we're like, think of how much money you could make if you could sell tickets to these events and like how much more income could come to the org and the players and
the overall ecosystem.
Yeah, right? And the ecosystem itself. So I think that that's like kind of the trade-off, right? It's like maybe this year the quality from like a LAN perspective is better, but maybe from a LAN practice perspective is better. But then maybe when you start paying people more, it changes their like ambitions and their expectations, and it's like, okay, well, I'm paying you this much, you got to do this, etc. Money definitely influences people, whether people like to hear that or not.
Yeah,
but there's definitely going to be a lot of, I think that needs to happen regardless of how well it's done the first year. I mean, I don't expect, if you look at season one of Overwatch League, there were a lot of mistakes and a lot of, you know, problems and a lot of like logistical things that I think could have been avoided, but you would never know that you needed to avoid them until after you had already, you know, trucked through them.
Sure.
And I expect that same thing to happen when we do start moving into that kind of system, where the first season is going to feel so awful because there's going to be all these little things that nobody planned for, that nobody could have planned for. And that's part of the job, I guess. Mm. But the end game of like a very fluid home and away, you're getting on your plane, you're getting off your plane, you're going to your nice hotel, you know.
Also just for the fans as well, not just for the players and the management, but for the fans to have that localized experience.
Yeah.
Is insanely important. I mean, NYXL put on a fantastic show around the Overwatch League finals. They had a pop-up store that, you know, they had almost an entire block wrapped in a queue for about 3 days. It was incredible. Like, I know that the Band Together tour that we did was a massive success with our fan base as well. It kind of leads me on to, as an extension of your point, is those local ecosystems being elevated by more local play. Just for the fan experience around Blizzard Arena, like around the Overwatch League finals, is there anything that you'd want to see more done for the fans in and around that experience? Because I've been to a whole host of major esports events this year, and I'm increasingly more surprised by the lack of stuff for fans to do actually around the arena,
rather than
just watch the games.
Yeah, what's interesting is I feel like, so I went to TI twice. I've been to two TIs. One TI 5, I want to say TI 4 or TI 6. I don't remember which ones I went to. I just know that I went to two back-to-back. And 1 year, there was a food festival going on, just like randomly. It just happened to be outside the arena. The dates lined up. It wasn't anything planned, right? And it was like the best weekend ever. It was like the best week at TI you could have had, because it was like you would leave the arena from the games and then you just had all this stuff to go do. You could go, like, there were like carnival rides. There was like all this like food you could try out and eat, and like a lot of like things you could get, like free swag.
It was more like a music festival.
Yeah, it was like, it felt like a music festival, and it felt like it was awesome, right? Like you had all this extra stuff to do. And I feel like that is missing in a lot of events. Mm. Like, it's like, I went to an ESL, not to like dump on ESL, but I went to an ESL New York, and it felt, for Dota, and like all you were doing was sitting in a theater watching Dota. Like,
yeah.
Is this better than watching on Twitch? Could I have not just done this at home with better food, you know, more, like the trade-off is there, right?
It's based on like, I think that the in stadium atmosphere, regardless of what's going on outside, is a truly unique experience. Yeah. And it's very different for each and every game just because of the peak and rise of actually what's happening in game. Like, that's an invaluable experience to have. But I 100% agree that...
It was different. Yeah. I mean, TI was great, right? Like, the in-person TI experience is very different. The ESL, it was like a very empty stadium.
Sure.
So it felt awkward. And I think that there was like a big contrast between like a TI and like a smaller tournament. if you could have TIs every week, everyone would do it, right? But even then, there was a massive difference in my mentality between the TI where there was just a random food festival outside and the TI where there was nothing. It was just like, okay, game's over, hotel.
Yeah.
And I think that that's like a big issue. I think that that's why BlizzCon, like stuff like BlizzCon is so cool, because you're creating an esports event that is also very directly related to, like, it's not catered to esports.
Sure.
It's an esports event at a non-esports convention.
Yeah.
And that is what I think separates the enjoyment factor, right? Like, if not, I don't want to like start throwing ideas out there, but if you could have an Outlaws game at E3, you would probably get more people interested in that game because they're like, okay, well, I'm at E3 anyway. I'll go watch the Outlaws. Like, yeah, I don't know what this is, maybe, but yeah. You're giving them something to do that isn't solely watch the games. It's hard to say what that thing is because I like, obviously, there's a lot of talk, especially now, about safety in terms of like protecting the players at esports events, and like that's always been a concern. I think like even when you're walking around E3, you think to yourself like any one of these people could end my career, like break my arm or something.
Yeah,
anything can happen in real life. And as we start pushing these boundaries, where I have players on television, where I have players being the spokesperson for multi-billion-dollar networks and you know companies, they become targets in a sense, in some way. And like there's a fine line between like safe and good, right? Like the fans might enjoy it, but maybe it's not safe. Finding that difference or finding that line is very hard, I would say.
Yeah, I understand that. It's when these kind of recent events, like in Florida, pop up, it does make people kind of take a step back and ask these questions about are we moving in the right direction? Is there anything else that we can do there? I think that what happened is awful, and you know, like you always have to say that when one of these things happen, even if you, I mean. I think that what happened is awful, but I'm a very staunch believer that letting very low probability, high profile events that get a spotlight by the media have an overarching impact on how we live our lives. I mean, you can take that as a piece of social commentary for the last 10 or 15 years to look at how unforgivable events in the US and also in the UK and probably perpetrated by those sides elsewhere have had a media spotlight put on them, which has irreparably changed people's lives regardless of actually how unlikely that is to happen again. So it's an interesting time to be having a conversation about what else can we do at these events, how can we open up the ecosystem, and how can we just pull on an awesome experience for everyone. You have to have that thought in your back pocket around let's do some cool stuff, but let's make sure that it's measured. I would love to see more in the industry, like the ESL's recent deal that was announced with Universal Music, where they're going to be trying to release new albums, new artists, and new licenses through esports play. That's a fantastic step in the right direction towards the esports festival experience in and around major events. If you look at, everyone will talk about this as well this week probably, but the Logan Paul versus KSI boxing match, that's a very, very strong example of how gaming culture and how millennials actually follow major personalities actually transcends out of those core markets such as gaming and esports. You know, I could see something where I'm not expecting Jake Raucus and even yourself to start boxing people in the ring from other teams. Maybe that's not the best idea for super competitive Overwatch, but you know, it's a way for us to view the industry as a way just to transcend into wider entertainment, which I think is really exciting.
Yeah, I do think as more money comes into like the ecosystem from like a org perspective. I mean, when you look at Overwatch League, it's like very much everyone's in the red, right? I think once there is green, like once the money does come back, and you know, you can justify spending on like maybe outrageous things that other orgs could do in the past that were less, you know, costly. There is more room for stuff like that, right? Like right now it'd be a hard pitch to sell, you know, maybe Raucus versus Jake boxing match, but at the same time
I think people
would watch it, is the point. Like you would get a lot of clicks, you would get a lot of,
you'd be surprised.
Yeah,
I think we're gonna see a whole host of different personalities coming in that have more of an inclination towards younger audiences.
I wanted to start a TV show actually this year. I wanted to do like The Amazing Race with just the Outlaws and just have everyone pair up and just like do the Survivor.
Yeah,
like stuff like that would be so cool.
That would be dope.
Like that's the kind of thing that would get millennials, or you know, whoever's watching esports, not even just millennials, like whoever's watching esports, to like want to watch some sort of crazy reality TV show kind of thing. Yeah. Without making it feel like you're watching their daily lives. Because that's like another trade-off too. Sometimes it feels like the videos get too personal on like what they're doing day to day. and giving like the players some sort of like out, you know, like we're going to take you to the middle of nowhere, drop you off on an island, we'll record it. Like that's good content in my opinion. But do we have the budget for that? No. But that's in my opinion, the next steps is like once the players have hit a certain point, once the ecosystem's in a good spot, like you movie stars do dumb things on television all the time. You see like cooks or chefs, like top chefs on Dancing with the Stars. Like that's like funny, you know, like that's cool. But are we there yet? No, but I feel like once we get there, like the esports wave will start hitting mainstream a lot harder than people think. Like even the it was Ninja and Drake.
Yeah.
Like that just got clicks. It didn't even matter how many clicks, it just got a lot. But yeah, the ninja story I think made a lot of people realize like what's Fortnite, you know?
Yeah.
Where did this guy come from? Who's Ninja? Why is he playing video games with Drake? Like and like once you start breaking that barrier, it becomes more normal, right? Like now everyone's like, okay, esports, Fortnite. Okay, I understand Ninja. Ninja's a name that I recognize. I mean, even the people closest to me, right? And I'm sure you, when you go home, your parents or, you know, your loved ones or even like very close relatives, it's like they still have to explain what you do as a job, right? Yeah. They still have to say, okay, my kid's the general manager of the Houston Outlaws. Like what's esports? What's the Outlaws? Like what's Overwatch?
Oh, is it the same as that Fortnite thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like you wind up in that conversation a lot. And like even for people, like I went to college with like all these kids my age and like it seems so obvious, right? Like it feels like they should just know what it like that this exists, but they don't. And it's like kind of the same, I think, as like EDM. Like I was super into festivals when I was in college and like some people just have never been, they've never listened to anything EDM. Like there's just all these different cultures that haven't hit video games or these different backgrounds that just haven't played or, you know, experienced the social aspects of video games. And like even yesterday, right, we went out for like a company barbecue and I was like, we're playing volleyball and I'm like, I have not gone outside and played volleyball in it feels like 10 years, but it used to be so normal, right? It used to, like I feel like I used to just go out and play sports and like enjoy myself like in that outdoor environment a lot. And like the shift in culture has like I feel like there's a middle ground, but it's really hard to hit without anybody hitting an extreme. Like you go into video games, you go into esports, you like that becomes your bubble.
Yeah.
And I feel agree. Like trying to branch the bubble between like mainstream sports and esports is like a very good next step, but like raising awareness for both of them is harder than everyone thinks. But that goes back to like the health and wellness kind of thing.
Sure.
Because I do think that there's probably definitely some sort of psychological advantage to playing video games for like an average human being that's never played before.
Yeah, I haven't poured through the data myself, so but I've read the headlines, which is what most people
do. I've read the internet. I checked Reddit.
I've seen the stuff around being highly exposed to playing games makes your ability to process a lot of information from different areas very very strong. So you know, you have inputs of, you know, like say if you're playing League, you have, or Overwatch, you have ability cooldowns, you have respawn cooldowns, you have objectives, you have
your vision, where's the enemy,
like you have
what cooldowns do they have,
and you have all of that stuff that they got to bear in mind and then act on very very quickly. And you know, the same area of the brain that lights up for chess, which has already been shown to demonstrate that it has a healthy impact on mental performance, is exactly the same for esports and hardcore gaming. So yeah, I 100% agree with you there. I think that's probably all we've got time for this episode. But let's just dive into one or two of those more personal questions that you said that you and your players don't enjoy as much, but we're gonna ask them anyway.
<I'll> do.
Do you have a mentor? And if you do, what's the best piece of advice that you've received? Doesn't have to be in the industry, it could be outside.
I don't want to say I'm a mentor. I think like the person that influenced my career or just like my future, I mean, like my parents are obviously the cliche answer, and they did a very good job of like teaching me respect and, you know, how to handle myself and what's right and what's wrong. But from like the perspective of like my job, I would say that like I most learned a lot from like that one high school coach who was very much like, this is what's going on, I have respect, like, you know, keeping that kind of mentality. It was like, it was interesting because this guy was like, in terms of like what he did for like these players' mentalities was like phenomenal, right? He was never like he never yelled at anybody, he never like gave anyone a really hard time, but somehow the team still had the same feeling of like, if I disappoint this one person, I've really made a mistake.
No, you're
and sure. I don't need this person to be mad at me to know that I'm screwed up or that I screwed up, right? And so like learning how that mentality existed and how like that respect was earned and like what he did as a human being to like enable his players and help them through like their lives in ways that weren't just, you know, the sport, which is like something I think that I try to model myself on. Like, obviously I have a lot of input when it comes to like the game, but in terms of helping the players shape their careers and like get them through like any sort of trouble that they have during the season, there was like a lot of loss this season that I don't think people even realize, like from a player perspective, like a lot of players lost somebody in their family or a close relative. And like, it's like stuff like that that's like really hard to process, I would say. Like, you already have Overwatch League pressure, and then you have your parents freaking out, you know, like at home, like upset about this, like grieving, and like going through stuff like that while you're also on this giant spotlight stage, and like you have to appear strong. It's like, it's very stressful, and it's very hard to replicate, right?
When you're confronted with that experience for the first time, especially as a younger person, in a high pressure environment, like being in the first season of the Overwatch League, like I can't imagine how much.
Your parents aren't there. Yeah, it's like I became like much more, like everyone always talks about like how close Outlaws is, but it's like it became a family because it needed to be, right? Like, you can't, a player can't go through something like that without support. Like, a player can't have a bad day without someone there to like back them up, and like
100%
trying to get that environment healthy and like keep it healthy. It's like, it's the same with everything, right? Like, once something bad happens, everyone kind of group, like it's like just like a the way humans are, right? Like, if a catastrophic event happens,
everyone
bands together. Yeah. And that's kind of how I think, for better or for worse, obviously, it's like a lot of bad things happened in the Outlaws world this year, and I think it brought everyone closer than even the videos would show, in terms of just like how they think and how they approach each other's mentalities and feelings and stuff. And like,
it's been one of the things I noticed just even earlier on in the season when I was down, was that it was very tight. But, you know, I can completely understand why having that experience with that coach, you know, even just gave you an example of what you want to strive for. And that's sometimes one of the most important things for people that influence you in your life, is you get these little nuggets of gold from them, be it like wisdom or experience, or like you see how they act, and then you just try and replicate that and make that your own. I think everyone tries to do that.
It's interesting from like my perspective too, because I always see like all these seminars on like what makes a good leader, you know, like that kind of thing. And I'm like, I don't think I could learn from a PowerPoint. I don't think I could learn from someone just telling me.
You learn by doing.
Yeah, you gotta learn by doing. You gotta learn by like experiencing. And like my mentality, or like my parents or my mom would always say, like, you know, leaders make good leaders. Like, you have to be led by someone. Like, it's when you have, it's also like when you work, right? Like, if you have multiple jobs, your first job, maybe your boss is awful, you hate him. And then maybe your second boss does something different that your first boss didn't. And you're like, I love this boss, because he does this differently. And maybe you didn't know how much the other boss like annoyed you or did things that really like you couldn't fix and couldn't pinpoint. But then like the more experiences you get, and that's just experience, right? Like, the more people that are put in power positions over you, the more different pieces you can start pulling from them. And even from like an infinite perspective, like, I learn a lot from the infrastructure here, just the people here. Like, everyone has a different way of doing things, and some things I really like, some things I don't. That's part of life though, right? Like, you always have people that do things you're not gonna always agree with, but understanding, you know, why they're doing that and like why they're like, it's all a bunch of learning. But the more people that you can learn from, the more of a complete picture you can paint for yourself. And that's kind of how I think I'm operating now. Sure. In some way.
No, I agree. Like, you need to view yourself as a project and take inspiration from other areas. The esports industry has no working hours, especially when you're working on the edge of, you know, pro play, when the hours are long, expectations are strong. Like, you've already mentioned that being in a leadership position has its own stresses and pressures. What do you do outside of prioritizing spending time with your dog? What do you do to stay sane in this industry? What's the one thing that you do for you?
I feel like this season was like a lot of reflecting in terms of like that specific question, because at the beginning of the season, I was like super stressed. Like, it was like just me, Chris, and Ryan, and it was like nobody else really from like the beginning, that like first day when I got hired. It was just the three of us, and it was like, okay, this is what we're doing. And so like, I was tasked with like make an Overwatch League team, right? Make it work, like get the right people, hire the right faces, get the right culture. And it was like a lot, like it was super overwhelming. So there was like a long period at the beginning where I felt like I was just overworked all the time. And like, that was fine. I knew what I was signing up for. I knew what the benefits were, what the downsides were. But then turning the middle of the season, the workload got way higher than I think I ever anticipated, from like Blizzard needs interviews, this magazine needs interviews. These people want photos. This guy wants to do a video. This guy needs you for this event this weekend. Sponsors want you to do this, et cetera, et cetera. And it became like really crazy. And I think like I lost track of myself somewhere in there. And it became like really stressful, like not knowing, am I going to be home in time to let my dog out? Am I going to be home in time to like do all these things? Do I have time to work out? Another thing that was really hard too to get used to was like Texas, right? So like you guys have meetings at 10 a.m. That's an 8 o'clock for me. And if I'm like trying to work out in the morning, like my mornings are suddenly like shot because I'm like very much the kind of person that like wants to wake up, be starving, pop pre-workout and just go lift.
Yeah.
And I can't do that on a daily routine if I'm like in meetings that start when I need to wake up.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of my first year going into even now has been me losing control over like myself. I feel like I've kept a good grasp on the team and, you know, like what's going on and been very responsible, but I definitely feel like I put myself second. And I think that like next season, that's like kind of my goal, is to like find time for me, if that makes sense. Like find time for myself to like chill. But it's hard, I think, you always feel like you can do better, I think, in my position. I feel like I can always be better. I can always do more than I'm doing. And that's like a bad mentality in a way, because I'm like, you put yourself in that position where you're burning yourself out, but it's because you feel like you can always, like if someone sends you an email at like 3 a.m., you feel like you have to respond. Like my brain like naturally tells me to respond to it.
Yeah.
But realistically, this was like advice I got from my mom actually last time I was talking to her. She was like, these people work 9 to 5s.
Yeah.
Most of them.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the 3 a.m. emails. Like just sleep through it. You know, deal with it when you wake up, after you eat breakfast, go to the gym first. You know, like things can wait. And yeah.
It's easy to get like wrapped up in the energy,
yeah,
of the activity that's happening around you.
It's like, I want this off my plate, I'm gonna do it now.
Yeah.
And that's like kind of the problem, I think, that,
and then that mounts up, and then like 3 hours later you haven't slept yet. That influences everything else. That's a really honest piece of feedback, and I empathize a lot with that, and with the rapid growth and activity of building like a new team in a new ecosystem where there are no kind of set processes in place of how things should be done. I can completely appreciate how you would get, you know, wrapped up in a whirlwind. But it's good that you've identified that for next year, and that's something that you can work on. Last thing I'm going to ask before I let you go: you do a lot of reflection internally. That's been pretty evident from this conversation. Do you have a motto? Is there anything that, any phrase that?
I have a motto. I think like the key like thing that I like want to do in general, and like I wish other people always did, is like lead by example. And that's kind of been like my go-to. It's like anything I do, I feel like I should expect other people to do, or other things other people do, I should be promoting stuff that I would do myself or feel like I should have done. It's like hard to preach to people. It's like an alcoholic telling you not to drink, right? Yeah. It's like if you're not also doing what you're telling other people to do, then they're not going to listen. And like that's kind of how I've been trying to like structure myself, is like if I expect a player to do XYZ, then I should be ready to do XYZ, kind of like mentality. And that's been kind of like my leadership style, I would say, for the past year, is like if the players have to wake up at 6 for content, I'll wake up with them for 6 set content. It's like, okay, you guys are suffering, like I'm suffering, like, you know, like you're not on an island kind of mentality, like someone else is there with you, and someone else who's telling you to be there is also there. You're not like losing out. This person's obviously putting in the time. And that's like kind of, I think, Tyrong's kind of biggest strength too, from a coaching perspective, is like when the players upset Tyrong, it's like, you know, Tyrong's busting his ass. So like if you're disrespecting Tyrong, you're disrespecting all the time he puts in, all like the work he's done, and he'll never do something to like harm you. So like, why would you do something to harm him? And like that kind of mentality is what I think propagates winning cultures. And so like, that's kind of always been how I wanted things to work, was just like, if the players have to get on an 8 a.m. flight to Shanghai, then I'm getting on that. Like, you know, like I'm there with them. I'm like helping them and like not just leaving them alone. Cause I think some teams are more lax in that regard, and maybe it works for them. Maybe they found a culture that works for them. But I think my biggest drive has always been do by others as I wish that they were doing onto me, kind of mentality. And that's where I think Outlaws is hopefully, or where I stand hopefully with them, et cetera.
I'd love to unpack that more, just to see, you know, if and when being there too much has a negative impact.
There's been a few times where I felt like I don't need to be doing this, or you know, I could let them go.
Like you set yourself
RTX, I let them. Yeah, RTX, I let them go by themselves. That was like the first time I was like, you know what, you guys go to Texas, figure it out. Yeah, you know, right. And I didn't regret it. It was good, but there's a limit, right? You have to earn the respect before you can keep it, and that's kind of, I think, the timer, right? Sure. So like season one, I think I burnt myself to a crazy degree, but they saw that, you know, like it's important that like they were all there for that. There's no doubt that like I'm putting my all into the team, and that is the last thing you want from like a player perspective, is your players thinking that their staff isn't as on board as they are, right? Yeah. And so there's like definitely a limit to that. I think I've learned. I don't think I'm going to go on every trip that they're going on this year. I'm not trying to like micro them anymore. You know, it's off season. Let them have their, you know, do their thing and get what they want out of the off season. But it's more of a scalability thing. Like work as hard as they are, if not harder.
And that makes sense.
That's kind of there's definitely a limit. Don't trust me. There's definitely a limit. I'm not trying to burn that hard, but making sure that the players never feel alone, I think, is one of my biggest jobs.
Especially in the first year when everything's so new. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Cool, man. I think that's an awesome place for us to end it. Thanks for the time. It's been awesome to kind of mine into your story a little bit more. How can everyone reach out to you if they want to get in touch? Is it Twitter or is it
Twitter,
LinkedIn?
Discord, LinkedIn. I've actually started getting LinkedIn messages quite a lot. I don't check LinkedIn that often. I get notifications, so like I'll see them, but...
What's the best app for Twitter and those other platforms?
I think Twitter's Flame IRL, which is awful. Hopefully Twitter will verify me and just let me get an actual like name. And then it's discord.gg/flame, which is very easy.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty accessible. There's also like email addresses and, you know.
Sure.
But I'm not trying to flood my inbox. I'll take the Twitter hit, not the email hit. The emails are already piling up.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. All right, guys, that's going to do it for this episode of the Esports Roundtable podcast. Thanks for your time. If you want to reach out to us or the show, it's at ES Roundtable Pod on Twitter. I'm at Barely Qualified. Stay tuned for us for a new episode next week.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.